We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 97. On today's show, we talk about liminal places, and more specifically, underpasses, with Rebecca Lambert. We also dig into the archaeology of the future. Sorry for the pun, but here's another one. Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. And joining me today is Rebecca Lambert. Rebecca, how's it going?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. So, all right. Well, let's talk about liminal spaces, because you were turned on to us by one of our producers, and I didn't actually talk to you or anything. And all I see is what we have you fill out as your, I guess, introduction to the podcast and what we're going to talk about. And I'll tell you what, it was so interesting to me because I didn't understand or know about anything that you put in there a lot of times.
It's funny you should say that.
Yeah, I know, right? Which is really good, because a lot of times we talk about this on one of my other shows, and we just recorded these guys on the Archaeotech podcast, and they use this brand new technique that we had never heard of before and applied it to archaeology. Whereas a lot of times we talk to people that are using existing and well-known techniques and then applying them to archaeology in new and different ways. But what I like about what you've got here, and we're going to dive right into this here in a second. But what I like what you've got here is, I mean, I personally have never, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and I personally never really thought about the things that you brought up here, which really is original research, which I love. And that's hard to find, I think, these days in archaeology. It's people are rehashing old things or answering new questions about old data sets and things like that. But this sounds like something that very few people have probably thought about in the past. And so I think it's going to be great for our listeners to learn more about it. So the key term to what you're talking about here, and you can find Rebecca's Twitter handle in the show notes here, and you can follow what she's doing on there. But the key thing is liminal places. So this podcast is for, really, it's for a general audience, people that aren't necessarily archaeologists. So can you first define what a liminal space is, or a liminal place is?
Yeah, of course. So basically, the term liminal is derived from the Latin word for threshold, which is limina. And it can signify something that's on the periphery of everyday society and denote the space amidst different strata of reality. And liminality, as archaeologists, we discuss liminality a lot, especially within prehistoric contexts. I'm primarily a Neolithic archaeologist, so liminality can be considered within human and architectural contexts, especially within, we look at ritual with liminality a great deal. And the way that I'm approaching liminality is looking at it from, I suppose you could say, shamanic perspectives.
Okay.
By descending into a trance-like condition, shamans enter into liminal states. And the way that I consider liminality is these permeable places. Traditionally, within prehistory, places such as passage graves and caves are considered permeable places, places where the living were in close contact with the past, the present, and perhaps even the future. And I actually believe that modern underpasses or subways can be deemed liminal places. So, yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned that you're, and I hear archaeologists say this all the time. They say, well, I'm primarily this archaeologist. However, I'm studying this thing that's completely unrelated, or it seems, to that thing that I just said I do. So you said you're primarily a Neolithic archaeologist. How the heck did you get interested in underpasses? What led to that journey?
Well, when I say I'm a Neolithic archaeologist, I mean, all of my projects apart from, oh, actually, no. I transgress. Two of my four projects do sort of step away from the Neolithic quite some distance. They deal with future tech, vaporware, and the hum.
Oh, okay.
But that's for another time, the dialects of the hum.
Yeah.
My two main projects at present, paranoid architecture and underpasses, liminal places. Although when people first hear those titles, they think, crikey, bang on 21st century. But actually, from a research perspective, although I'm looking at these 20th and 21st century architectural constructs, the reasoning behind the research is tethered quite strongly to the Neolithic. In Britain, the Neolithic is considered to have come into being roughly around 4000 before Common Era and went up to approximately 2200 before Common Era. So, a great expanse of time. So within the Neolithic period in Britain, but also within continental Europe and other places, we start to see real sort of physical evidence towards potential ritual activities. We start getting these most amazing cairns, burial chambers, tombs being created that many still stand today. And we have to try and ponder, why were they built? We know that some of them hold the remains of people. Mm-hmm. Some of them don't. That could be because those remains have been removed for whatever reason. But also of the tombs that have been excavated where remains have been found, when we consider the number of people that were probably living within British Isles during the Neolithic period, well, there were far more people roaming the islands than are found within these tombs. So then we have to think, well, how did these people end up in tombs and in cremated burials and others didn't? Where are all the other people?
Sure.
So then we have also these huge monuments coming into being. So Stonehenge is known around the world, but we also have the Ring of Brodgar and the Stones of Stenness up in the Orkney Isles, which is just off the coast of northern Scotland. We're very lucky to have lots of different sites. I won't reel off a list. People can have a look or contact me via Twitter. And we have to start thinking, well, why are these beginning to be built during this period? And we then start thinking, well, we're starting to evidence very sophisticated societies being formulated. And what we have to remember as well is that during the same time as the Neolithic is occurring in Britain, if we look to Egypt, the Egyptians are creating the most amazing monuments as well, the pyramids of Giza and so on. So although they're coming into being at the same time, they look very different to what's occurring in Britain. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's just different cultures manifesting their belief systems physically in different ways, which is really interesting too.
Yeah.
But back to the question of liminality, sorry. I ponder and wonder.
No, this is great.
All right. So when we, as I said earlier, and we look at liminality, these spaces on the periphery, spaces where things can happen, they can be potentially benevolent or malevolent spaces. Good things could happen, bad things could happen. And lots of people immediately think of liminal spaces being dark and underground. Now, that is true to some extent, but we also can see liminality in different contexts. The sea is a highly liminal space. Mm-hmm. But if we follow the general thinking of these dark subterranean spaces, I've spent a lot of my life in underpasses from my childhood through. Yes, I was one of those people who used to hang about getting up to no good in underpasses.
Right.
I always felt very safe in them as well and never really felt threatened. And yeah, it wasn't till the past sort of 18 months, I was just wandering through one of my favorite underpasses, as you do.
Right, of course.
And it just kind of struck me. I was like, well, hang on, this, how is this underpass, although it's physically bigger than a passage tomb, the logistics are kind of the same. Yeah, no one's buried in here, but it's long, it's fairly dimly lit, it's kind of dark. And underpasses do you know, lots of ritual activities take place within underpasses. And then that just started my thinking. And people were sort of saying, well, Rebecca, you know, are you going off on one or something? And I was like, no, bear me out. And the way that I have sort of started to formulate this theory was that underpasses are spaces that bear witness to ritual behaviors, such as, you know, drinking, drug taking, communal gatherings. I've put this politely, acts of sexual congress. And they all, you know, these all done to initiate feelings of euphoria with the hope of achieving altered states of consciousness, altered states of reality, not unlike what occurs within ritual activities, even today in a number of modern cultures. So the underpass is a place where, for myself, new identities and agendas can be forged, and where all acts, however small, are significant.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in within the underpass, there's a suspension of disbelief. I believe it's a link between the routine every day in more than one way, not just from the, you know, the logistical of being able to move from one part of a town or city to another part, but it's also a link with the more than human world. And as with all liminal spaces, underpasses have to be, you know, they have to be approached with caution. And I think that's not just from the sort of 21st century view of, oh, I'm a person going into an underpass, I, you know, something could happen to me, but also, you know, from these angles that we are going into something. I'm going underground, but I'm not quite underground.
Mm-hmm.
I'm traveling through different spheres. And regardless of the length of the underpass, you know, am I going to go through some sort of rite of passage on my journey through that underpass, no matter how small? Am I going to be the same person emerging from the other side of the underpass as the person who entered? So, yes. I hope that kind of made sense. Sort of. Stop rambling.
Well, and I want to make sure that we're not, you know, we have a pretty large audience over in England and in the UK. But I do want to make sure that we're not encountering some sort of, you know, regional or cultural difference in language here. When I think of underpass, I'm thinking of all sorts of spaces, like basically under a road, right? Under a road where another road goes under that road, or even where, you know, a river or something else goes under that road, yes. But they're like a bridge, right?
Yes.
And all those spaces under there. Is that?
Yes.
You're literally referring to those spaces, right?
Yeah. So an underpass can be, as you said, going underneath a road, going underneath a river. It can also be with our motorways or freeways, the bridges that go underneath those. It's anything. So
yeah.
Underpasses are, although they may look slightly different, an underpass is an underpass no matter where it is in the world, and there's no specificity as to that British underpasses are the only ones I'm looking at. In fact, I'm currently running a phase of the project where I've had stickers, underpasses and liminal spaces stickers created, and 60 very lovely people who are based around the world, got a fair number within the UK, but also the USA, Canada, Australia, Portugal, throughout Scandinavia, taking these stickers. They're choosing their underpass and they're placing the stickers within the underpass. They're photographing it as soon as they've placed the sticker. And then every couple of weeks, they go back and take another photograph to see whether or not those stickers are subjected to any ritual activities themselves, you know, whether that be veneration or desecration, or if indeed they're just left alone, nobody pays them any attention. It's just so, for myself, the fact that we've got this project that's now going all over the place is great. I mean, I'm still blown away that people are interested in this research, because for, you know, when people, you know, people say, oh, archaeology, and they think trenches, temples, castles. So I've been really blown away by the enthusiasm of people. And
yeah.
And I think, I don't know if that's because it's something quirky or niche, or whether it's because they think like I do, in the sense that archaeology is everywhere. You don't have to go to a crumbling castle. You don't have to travel miles and miles to be within and around archaeology. It's on your doorstep. And
sure,
the things, especially my projects, all of them, they focus on the fact that they work within local, regional, national and international contexts, and the fact of connectivity, which for me is really important, more so now than ever with the world we're living in. And maybe it's because people can now look at their underpass or even think, oh, well, actually, that is archaeology. And if people can walk out their door and look around them and see, you know, their landscapes in a different way, perhaps and explore them a bit more, engage with them a bit more, perhaps engage with others looking at these, then for me, that's really cracking. That's a really good thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Well, that gives us a lot of places to go in segment two. And we are going to do that right in a minute when we come back from these messages. And I just want to mention to our audience, if you're listening to this and you're about to hear some of these are ads for the Archaeology Podcast Network and services on there and services related to it, but they're also advertisements for people that support the Archaeology Podcast Network and businesses and things that we support, and ones that want to support us and keep these things going, because we have over 25 people that are basically volunteering to keep this network going and to bring information about underpasses that you never thought you would have to the wider world, to our 50,000 monthly downloads, right? So
oh, crikey.
Please, no, right? Please contact us. You can contact us at advertising@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com if you want to tell our audiences about what you do and your goods and services and help support archaeological education and outreach in the process. We'll be back in just a second.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to Zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 97. And I am talking with Rebecca Lambert about underpasses. And one of the things you mentioned in the last segment, when you were talking about the types of spaces that underpasses are and the kinds of things you can find there, and, you know, are you the same person when you go in and come out? And I was thinking about it. I go under underpasses all the time. My wife and I actually live in an RV. So we go under, obviously, underpasses all the time. But even when you're doing it in a car or something like that, you're in a nice, safe bubble space. But as an average white guy here in the United States, when I'm walking or on my bicycle or something like that, we used to live in downtown Reno, not exactly a scary city for as compared to other cities. But, you know, when you're walking or you're going down to one of those spaces, you are entering someone else's domain, really.
Exactly.
Because people live down there, people stay down there, they're dark. You might not be able to see exactly what's going on when you go through there. You don't know really what's going to happen and whether or not you're going to make it out the other side. I'm being overly dramatic here. They're not all like
No, but not at all.
But you're totally right. That is the kind of, I never really thought about them as like another world, but you really are entering someone else's domain for the most part and coming out of that domain on the other side. And that's an interesting perspective on that.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think with underpasses as well, it's this sense that we accept that you know, they're an essential element for traversing the landscape, especially within cityscapes. But, you know, we don't enjoy moving within them.
Right.
You know, we do approach them with trepidation. You know, we don't, you don't really see many people apart from myself strolling leisurely through an underpass. You know, they're not the realm of the flaneur, so to speak. We do try and navigate them as quickly as possible. And a friend of mine, Paul Dubosczyk, he says, you know, that they are still replete with our fears and anxieties, you know, about venturing below the surface. That's something that's deeply inherent within humans, I think.
Right.
And, you know, underground spaces, you know, they're dark. They're full of dark, invisible recesses. You know, they harbour potentials for subversion, you know, poorly lit often, as you said. And it can be a restricted space. Now, even if you're in a big underpass, you're still restricted because you're restricted from your movements. You can only go one of two ways, forward or back.
Yeah.
So it can often feel claustrophobic, scary, you know, unnerving. But also, turning that on its head, they can also be considered, you know, slower, calmer, perhaps even safer in some respects, especially if you're in a pedestrian underpass. If you've come from a main road, a very noisy main road, which can be very disorientating and quite frightening, especially if you've got large trucks and fast cars coming past you, and then you delve into this underpass, and it's suddenly the sound, it goes very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a number of people, that could be just as, you know, unnerving. For myself, I find it almost meditative. And it's a sense of you're permeating. You're coming from one realm and then you're permeating into this next realm.
Right. It's amazing how quickly that attitude towards the space can switch too, because I was just thinking, you know, I've been in many situations. I used to live in, say, the upper Midwest in the United States, and you could get a hailstorm happening real fast, you know, or some sort of thing. And you're driving along the interstate or something. I used to have a motorcycle back then too. And tell you what, if you're on a motorcycle in a hailstorm, you're not going to have a really great day. Yeah. And when you see an underpass and you can get under it and have that relative safety under there, it doesn't really matter what's going on under there. You're going in and you're going to feel safer. And, you know, and also when you have car repairs, if I have a flat tire on a hot day or something like that, and I'm out on the highway, if I can see that underpass coming and I can make it, I'm probably going to go sit in the relative, you know, safety and security of the shade and the enclosed area, because we do like being, I don't know if it's from in the womb or what, but we like being enclosed. we like being wrapped in things.
Yes.
And sometimes that can be comforting, like you said, you know, coming from one environment into the other. So it's really cool to think about that way. So thinking about this, now that you're asking these questions, you're looking at these spaces in maybe a different way than people have in the past, what kind of data collection are you doing? You mentioned the stickers and sort of crowdsourcing some data around the world like that way, but what kind of questions, and then how are you answering those questions of the day? Are you interviewing people? Are you actually doing any excavations on some underpasses? You know, how's that look?
Well, so I'm in the fairly early stages of the research. So at present, as I said, we're doing this stickering process. So the photographs that are being sent back to me every couple of weeks, I've got individual files for each of the participants. I'm asking them to probably wrap up photographing those underpasses by the end of October, maybe November, for people overseas, because the post is slow at present. So some of them haven't received their stickers yet. Then I'm going to be looking at the biography, so to speak, of each sticker within its underpass to see if there's any noticeable change. And then look at those in relation to the stickers from different parts, not just of the UK, but from the project as a whole. And then see if I can, through interpretation, if there's anything that's really blazing out to me. I mean, I must admit, one of my participants who is based in Wiltshire, which is in southern England, he's based not far from Stonehenge, actually. He's looking at a couple of underpasses in particular where we've had some really interesting activity just in the past couple of weeks, where the in one of those underpasses, he placed the sticker directly on top of some graffiti, and it's been removed. And so this is sort of making me ponder questions. We were discussing it the other day, actually. So who removed the sticker? Was it a council official? Well, if they removed the sticker, then what's to say that they wouldn't have done something to try and cover up the graffiti? But that's quite an expensive business. And then I said, but also it could be that maybe the person who created that graffiti removed the sticker, because by you placing the sticker on top of the graffiti, they might have thought that you were desecrating their art. So then it's, so we're sort of thinking outside the box, which is what I love to do. And then the other underpass where he's placed a sticker, the sticker's been removed, but all that graffiti has been covered over by paint. But it's quite interesting because the graffiti artists are coming back now and are already starting to put their mark upon that underpass. And that's quite interesting because that is going to be the next stage of the project. So from probably springtime, I'm going to be looking at, I'm going to be comparing, so public commissioned art within underpasses as opposed to graffiti, because that's something that I find really interesting, that we have this, people going into underpasses and there's this fear, this trepidation. So when you get government funded, whether local or national government funded art within underpasses, why is that? Is that done to distract the people who are using the underpasses? And if so, why? Is it to distract them from any potential fears or so on? And then with commissioned art, it can also, if they're looking at a lovely piece of art, maybe it removes that person from the underpass, transports them elsewhere. So in a way, we're then back to these liminal spaces, enabling altered states, movement equating to transition. But then when we look at graffiti, I mean, I find graffiti incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
With graffiti artists, so tagging those very specific visual icons for each artist, deeply symbolic, you know. So, and often gangs have tags specific to themselves as well. And many underpasses around the world bear witness to this almost territorial art form. But it works on so many levels, you know, because if an artist is spraying their tag within an underpass, but anywhere really, it's a visual indicator that that is their art, their space, their territory, for want of a better term. And that message would be really clear and direct to other graffiti artists, street artists. And, you know, sometimes you will get, you know, underpass can be contested spaces, because sometimes you will get rivals venturing into these spaces which have been claimed in a way and declared out of bounds to them. And these rivals will then spray their tags over those of the resident artists. So these can be considered declarations of insubordination by those who control the space, so to speak. But for those who aren't involved in street art culture, gang culture, but don't understand it, but still have to use these underpasses, you know, these tags again offer really different meanings, because it's highly likely that those individuals wouldn't be able to, A, you know, differentiate between or read, so to speak, the direct meaning of the individual tags, unlike people immersed within the culture. So these symbols, in effect, can't be considered icons outside of street art communities, because they can't be read by everyone. Also, these non-participants wouldn't understand intergroup threats that were being made through war by art, so to speak, tags over other tags. But, you know, but the stylization alone, you know, coupled with the assumption that graffiti and tags are automatically linked with gang culture, that immediately makes these non-members anxious and leads to assumptions, you know. So the public immediately connects street art tags with deviant behavior, which in turn emphasizes any internal trepidations about having to navigate these spaces. And so if we look at all this and put it together, the initial desire of the graffiti artist to highlight that the tagged space is their domain, that you can only pass through if you observe this and pay due deference, so to speak, whether knowingly or not, is still conveyed to the non-members of street art communities, but just through different means. You know, the public may not be able to read the work explicitly, mm-hmm. or even understand if others are trying to upset the status quo, so to speak, within the realm of the underpass, but they will be able to decipher that these markings were made by people from specific cultural groups that are different to their own. They're other, perhaps even deviant. And armed with that knowledge, they will understand that they mustn't tarry within those areas, that they have leave to traverse it, but only through the permission of others. So although those tags, they're not icons in a classic semiotic context, they can be read and understood, but just within different nuanced forms. So on multiple levels by people both within and without street art culture. So we're coming into like different, we're approaching from a different angle. So we're going into liminality, we're going into control, contestation, but through ways that perhaps people wouldn't initially think of. So this is going to be the next major thread of the project, looking at art within underpasses. And then from that, the next stage, which is still very much in its fledgling phase, is, I don't know if you have these in the States, but certainly in the UK, parts of continental Europe, a lot of underpasses have bollards at either end of them to sort of restrict access in a way. So I guess it's to, if people are on motorbikes, scooters, bicycles, they have to get off them in order to go through the underpass and so on. And also, I don't know if you have this problem in the States, but in Britain, our supermarkets, the shopping trolleys, we have people who like to just take the shopping trolleys and just take them all over the place and leave them. And my friend Galloway Reese, who wrote a fantastic book called Car Park Life, sorry for advertising, but it's a really good book. He's got a new book coming out, which I won't advertise, but have a look.
That's fine. Yeah.
Oh, is it? Oh, right. And yeah, he's got another really good book coming out. Oh God. And I've forgotten the title. He's going to kill me, but just Google Galloway Reese. He's great. And he does a whole section about supermarket trolleys, how they're bought out. So
nice.
But I'm digressing. Sorry. We're looking at these underpasses. They're blocking off certain people, or they're controlling movement through them. And again, this takes us back to the Neolithic, because with henge monuments, so places like Stonehenge and so on, we can't see from the architecture now because it hasn't survived, because it would have been built in wood, a lot of these palisades. But we can still tell from geophys and so on that there were palisades set up around, not just within the Stonehenge landscape, but other landscapes that would have controlled movement. And it's highly contested as to why this was done, social segregation. There are also arguments, I believe it, that social segregation did take place for numerous reasons, but also that these were set up to segregate those not considered worthy of the secret knowledge, that the special knowledge, secret knowledge, was kept within the realms or in the central realms of these monuments during specific rites, so to speak, festivals, whatever word you want to use. And that by having palisades, by having very deep ditches, very high banks that would have restricted access and viewing of these rites and rituals, that these were implemented in order to protect this special knowledge. And British archaeologist Julian Thomas has written about this at length. And this is something that I'm starting to ponder in relation to underpasses, that they're being sort of restricted because maybe there's knowledge and things occurring in underpasses that only certain people are meant to know about.
Well, okay then. And that leads me to so many more questions, and we're going to tackle those on the other side of the break in the final segment of this podcast. We'll be back in a second.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the final segment of the Archaeology Show, episode 97, with Rebecca Lambert. And I got to say, one of the things I was thinking about when you were discussing all these ideas in the last segment, especially like the graffiti, and I'm thinking about the people that are down there leaving this graffiti and the back and forth with, you know, cleaning it up and then the tags on tags and the competition, things like that. I'm thinking another type of person, I should say, that inhabits these spaces are homeless people.
Exactly.
And people can become homeless for any number of reasons. You know, sometimes it's mental illness, sometimes it's financial reasons, sometimes it's employment, you know, whatever the case may be, people could become homeless for different reasons. But especially in this weird time that we're in right now, where people have lost jobs. I mean, unemployment in the United States, the unemployment benefits from the federal government that were extended and increased from what you would normally get have just ended this weekend as we're speaking.
Yes.
And there's a delay in Congress for getting that back again. And unfortunately, a lot more people could become homeless, especially since a lot of rents have been delayed but not forgiven, and when those start coming due and things like that. So if you have an influx of not usually homeless people, I don't want to say the type of person that would be homeless, you know, that's not the way to characterize it, but an influx of people who are not used to being homeless, you know what I mean, people who are not used to that sort of financial situation, suddenly finding themselves in that sort of financial situation and then thrust into these spaces that were formerly not theirs. Yep. And now they're like, where else am I going to go? You know, I need shelter. I need to be here. I'm going to go there. I'm wondering what that clash is going to look like. Not to put an academic spin on a horrible human situation, but I'm wondering what that's going to look like in the archaeological record, how this is going to impact those spaces and how ultimately it would impact your research on these spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I was just I was reading about the situation in the United States yesterday, and I can't remember whereabouts it was, but people were blocking the federal courthouse so that the landlords couldn't get in to start filing eviction notice. Yeah. I mean, crikey, you know, it's terrifying. It's crazy. And yeah. I'm quite open to admit I was homeless for a time a number of years ago. So I completely understand where you're coming from on this.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I think it works on a number of levels because, as you said, these people who have been put in this, I mean, nobody chooses to be homeless.
Sure.
So when you've got these people that, because of the coronavirus and so on, have been put in these absolutely impossible situations and are in the very real position that they could be homeless within a matter of weeks, if not a shorter period, where do I go? Well, not everyone's lucky enough to have family or friends who can offer to put them up. So then you think, well, you've got all these number of things. You want to go somewhere where you feel safe, where you aren't visible. Because if you're not visible, then there's less chance that you could perhaps be hurt in any way, you know, attacked or so on. But then you've then got the dichotomy. Well, the underpass, yes, I could go in there. It's dark. I could go and hide in there. But then you've got that creeping inherent trepidation within, but I don't want to go in there because it's dark. I don't know what's in there. There could be other people in there. Could be other homeless people in there. There could be people taking drugs in there, drinking heavily, goodness knows what. So you've got that. But then looking at this within the archaeological record, if we do get a huge influx of homeless people, well, I mean, it can manifest in so many ways. In the sense, certainly from a material culture point of view, you will find that there will be things such as, you know, sleeping rough. If you're lucky enough to get a sleeping bag, if you're having to eat out of cans and things, lots of people try and maintain and will use bins and things, but there aren't always bins available in that. And when you're on your uppers and you're having to eat out of a can, then, you know, sometimes you think the world's turned their back on you. You just think, well, you know, excuse my language, but sod it. I'm just going to throw the can on the floor or whatever. Or, yeah, if someone gives me a couple of bucks expecting me to go and buy a sandwich, but I've had a really awful day, no, I'm going to go and buy a beer, you know, and fair play. So I think from a material culture point of view, the sort of things that people gather around them, especially if they're homeless on a long-term perspective, we will be able to see. However, I think as well, though, because of the way that local and central governments work, it seems like they have no problem with making people homeless.
Right.
But they are quite happy to wipe away any physical evidence of homeless people on their streets. So when we say about the record, all these homeless people, we will be able to see it quite easily. I don't know if that will be the case, because I think that, and this is an awful thing to say, but that, because in Britain we have councils, I'm not sure what you have in the United States, so we have our local councils and things, will just physically wipe away all evidence of these people from their streets because they want to present in a very certain way. And they don't, even though they know they have homeless people, they don't want those nice people in their homes to have to see homeless people.
Right.
And so on. So archaeologically, I think it could be difficult. I suppose the only way, if the physical is wiped away, the way we look at it is like with digital archaeology, the internet recording these incidents and uploading to the net, and certainly in years to come, and this is part of another project I'm working on, archaeologists in the future, I think, will be looking perhaps more so to the World Wide Web and to excavate the World Wide Web in order to be able to uncover the people of the 20th and 21st century. Because I think that the way things are going, people who are further down the social ladder are going to become fainter and fainter within the physical because of government policy throughout the world. And that's a really sad thing to think about.
Yeah, you're right. And this reminds me of another episode recorded on another podcast, actually the CRM Archaeology podcast, where it was mentioned, the person doing this wasn't on the show, but we were talking about it. And it was mentioned that this person was recording in real time some of the graffiti around police stations and things right after the death of George Floyd.
Yes.
At the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department.
Yes.
And it was over in, I think, Virginia or something like that. And they were recording statues being, torn down. They were taking pictures of and recording the graffiti because well-intentioned citizens the next day, and this happened in downtown Reno, were cleaning up that graffiti.
Yes.
They were like, oh, our beautiful city. But then this history is, as it's happening, is being erased. And I'm wondering, when you're talking about future archaeologists, I'm wondering if our job as archaeologists with our particular skill sets, you know, we're always seen as studying the past, but we might have to study and record the present in order to study the past in the future, because it's being wiped out as we go. And I've thought about this as a CRM archaeologist my whole career, because I work in mostly Nevada these days. I worked all over the country, but most of these days I work in Nevada and California. And a lot of times what we're recording and using to understand the past is people's garbage, right? Yeah. We're finding tin cans, we're finding glass. But people tend to clean up now. And not only that, but we have roadside cleanup efforts where, you know, I only know about the age of an old road in the desert because I can look at the trash alongside that road because people didn't have anywhere to throw it, right? So that's how I know how old that road is. I've got old maps and I've got the trash on the road. And I mean, I literally did a survey with my wife, who's also an archaeologist, a metal detector survey of an old path from the late 1800s. And we were able to find like wagon parts and things like that and identify the time period with which this was used. But you just can't do that now because people clean up, people do things. So it's interesting to think about that, is that archaeologists might have to end up recording, you know, recording the present in order to, you know, in order to study it later and learn from it. It's crazy.
And I really do think that that's going to happen. I mean, this is something, another project. This is Future Ghosts. And I'm actually giving a paper on this at the TAG conference, the Theoretical Archaeology Group conference in December. That paper's going to be slightly strange because it's the session that it's running in. It's called Archaeologies of the Near Future. And that's being convened by Jim Leary of the University of York, another Neolithic specialist. And good chat. So, and he's asking us to look forward 200 years into the future. So we're going 2220. Will there be archaeologists? If so, how will they do archaeology? And this is something I've pondered for years in various ways, that perhaps 200 years into the future, I mean, if there are still humans, hopefully there are, if there are archaeologists, if the planet is still inhabitable in the sense that we can go outside to do field work.
Sure.
I mean, we don't know if that will be the case. But I think that the internet, as it is now, I mean, if we think in the past sort of 20, 30 years, how technology has sped up and, you know, the things that we have now, what we're going to have 200 years into the future, I sort of like to think that archaeologists in 2220 won't have trowels. They would have got rid of the trowels, they would have got rid of the magnetometers, all that, the drones, and they will be excavating via search engines, advanced search engines.
Right.
And they will be going through the stratigraphy of people's online lives, so to speak, through whether that's through social media, shopping, dating. Perhaps, and that's romantic dating people, not archaeological dating, or maybe, you know, and all the facet, you know, what they watch on TV, what music they listen to. I mean, there's so much.
That brings up something too, because all these sources of data for people, like, for example, when you said what you watch on TV, like my wife and I, we don't have cable like a lot of people in this generation. We watch plenty of Netflix and we watch plenty of Hulu and HBO Max, and those services are recording what we watch on TV. Yeah. But who's going to have access to that? Who has access to that now, for that matter? You know, like who could even see that now? If somebody famous dies, right? And then somebody wants to study their life and write an autobiography. Can they even go to Netflix and say, give me their viewing history? I don't think that Netflix would give it to them. And in that case, going along the lines of the internet in general, the internet only exists if two things happen. One, you have electricity. And two, you know how to read the data and you have the ability and the equipment to do that. So if a cataclysm happened tomorrow and we lost power across the entire planet, you know, some solar flare destroyed everything and we're back to the literal dark ages, the internet's all great to have that history, but we're not going to be able to read it, you know, and then enough time goes by and people won't even know. If even one generation goes by, there's not going to be people that even know if they did reestablish electricity. Okay, now how do we turn these computers on? Is the data even viable? Is it still good? Is it, you know, it's just, it's so volatile. And you know, you're talking 200 years in the future. Man, I wonder if there's going to be anything here 200 years into the future. If something happens between now and then, it's crazy.
I'm now feeling quite depressed.
Right?
I'm kind of thinking H.G. Wells, Jules Verne version of the future, you know, flying cars and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that happens, trust me.
No, but you're absolutely right. And also, I think, I mean, as you say, if we can't access, if we can access it, I mean, because I don't know if we are around in 200 years, if there is electricity, or we've got these amazing generators around the world that we've managed to get working with piggy poo, as they did in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. I mean, who knows? But I'm being polite for the listeners. And we can explore that. And also, I like to think, and this is me going out on one, I suppose, that perhaps archaeologists of the future will be like the mediums. So, you know, we have mediums now who can connect with spirits, and so they purport that perhaps our future archaeologists will be mediums, and they're connecting with the people of the 20th and the 21st century through digital Ouija boards, that they're going in, they're finding search engines and whatever, and they're managing to get back into the past and not just look at individuals as we do as archaeologists, but also, you know, the events that you were talking about just a short while ago with the Black Lives Matter protests, and not just that, but going way back. I mean, I think it's a dichotomy. It's a real catch-22, isn't it, in the sense that there's a fear of being filmed all the time. I was talking with someone about this last night. I'm a big fan of J.G. Ballard, a huge fan of J.G. Ballard. And this thing that, and Ballard says, you know, people wanted to be observed. They just want to be observed. And that's why things like Big Brother and that became, the program became so popular. And in Britain, we have a huge amount of CCTV cameras. There's all this stuff, and nobody really seems to be bothered. And I find it really strange that all these people who are anti-government, conspiracy theorists, yada yada yada, are refusing to wear masks. And it's like, well, come on, they're giving you carte blanche to wear masks. That's the best thing, because they can't see your face, so you can just go and do stuff, mess it up a bit. So yeah, not that I'm purporting to anyone to do that, you know. Well, you can if you want, but so I find that kind of odd.
Right.
But we have all these cameras and things, and part of me, when I go out filming and watching people, if they're cleaning up monuments and so on, I try not to video people's faces. I try to video the act.
Sure.
Because of people. But I think it has to be done, though, because like you said, they are erasing history. One aspect of history, a horrible part of history, has been brought down, and quite rightly so. But then people are coming, like you said, with the best intentions, but not always, because in Britain it was far right people that were doing this, are then themselves erasing that history that has literally just occurred within the previous 24 hours. I mean, it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a mind boggler.
I feel like we could just continue talking about this for, you know, several more hours, and perhaps we will. We should have you back on to keep talking about this, because there's so many things that you sent us that we didn't even get a chance to talk about. So
thank you. That's kind.
Thank you so much for coming on. And I hope that as this research progresses, we can bring you back on for a status update. I'm really interested to hear how your experiment with the stickers goes and what you can learn from that around the world. And I think that would be just really fun to learn about and see where it's going. And I'm hopeful and yet terrified at where the world is going. But perhaps we as archaeologists can learn from that. And we might not learn from it immediately, or the society won't learn from what we tell them immediately. They might not learn from what you're saying immediately.
Yeah.
But hopefully somebody 100 years from now, when they're trying to recreate human society, can find this research and say, wow, we should make that mistake again.
So, that's what my mom keeps telling me.
thank you. Right? Right? All right. So, well, thank you, Rebecca, for coming on. And we'll be back next week. Actually, next week on the Archaeology Show, we've got a lot of good shows coming up. Next week, we have a crossover episode with the Historical Yarns podcast about Neanderthals making yarn 40,000 years ago. So that's going to be great.
That sounds fantastic.
I know. Yeah. And then the episode after that, I never have this many schedules, so I have to tell our audience. The episode after that, we have a gentleman coming on to talk about historic fuels. I don't even know what that means. Fuel used in history and prehistory and things like that. So that's going to be fascinating as well. A lot of good topics. So thanks again, Rebecca. And thanks to our audience for listening. And we will see you guys next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.